In the underworld, Colin heard the soft echo of laughter from a different spirit. The malevolent chuckle made her skin crawl. As Colin came out of the trance of the gathering, the elders were there, standing around her. They were more used to this altered state than she. Her head still spun sickeningly. Elder Bregenderen reached down, offering her his hand to help her up. As she took his hand, under the covering of black and white mud, she saw the tokens on his legs. She gazed up into his face at his kindly smile of assurance. He would be dead within the day. Her friend, Savidlin, was there, holding out her clothes. Colin, despite the mud, suddenly felt very naked. She started pulling on her clothes, trying not to betray her embarrassment, and at the same time chiding herself for such mundane concerns in the face of the impending catastrophe. The gathering was about calling the spirits of the dead, not about being man or woman. Still, she was the only one of the latter, and they were all the former.
"Thank you for coming, Mother Confessor," the birdman said. "We know this homecoming is not the one of joy we all wished."
"No," she whispered, "it's not. My heart sings to see my people again, but the song is tempered by sadness. You know, honored elders, that Richard and I will do what we must. We will not rest until this is stopped."
"Do you think you can stop such a thing as a fever?"
Surin asked. Savidlin placed a hand on her shoulder as she buttoned her shirt.
"The Mother Confessor and Richard with the Temper have helped us before. We know their hearts. Our ancestor said that this is a fever caused by magic. The Mother Confessor and the Seeker have great magic. They will do what they must."
"Savidlin is right. We will do what we must."
Savidlin smiled at her.
"And then, when you have finished, you will come home to your people and be wedded, as you planned. My wife, Wesselin, wishes to see her friend, the Mother Confessor, wedded in the dress she made for you."
Colin swallowed back a cry.
"There is nothing I could wish that would bring me greater joy, except to see all our people well."
"You are a great friend to all our people, child," the birdman said. "We look forward to the wedding, when you have finished with these matters of the spirits and magic."
Colin glanced at all the eyes watching her. She didn't think these men had witnessed the visions of death she had been shown, the true nature or dimensions of the epidemic they faced. They had all seen fevers come before, but never one like the plague.
"Honored elders, if we fail, if we...
Her voice faltered. The birdman came to her rescue.
"If you should fail, child, we know it will not be because you didn't do everything you could. If there is a path, we know you will do all you can to find it. We trust in you."
"Thank you," she murmured.
Tears were watering her vision. She forced herself to hold her chin up. She would only frighten these people if she showed her fear.
"Colin, you must wed Richard with the Temper."
The birdman chuckled softly as if trying to cheer her.
"He escaped wedding a mud woman before, as I had planned for him. He will not escape wedding you, if I have any say. He must marry a mud woman."
She felt too numb to return the smile.
"Will you stay the rest of the night?"
Savidlin asked.
"Wesselin would find joy in seeing you."
"Forgive me, honored elders, but if I am to save our people, I must return at once. I must go to Richard and tell him what I have learned with your help."
Chapter 44 A woman stepped out of a doorway into the narrow, deserted alleyway. He had to stop or collide with her. Under her shawl, she wore a thin dress, and he could tell by the way her nipples stood out with the cold that she wore nothing underneath the dress. She thought his smile was for her. It wasn't. It was amusement at the way opportunity sometimes stepped into his path when he least expected it. He guessed it was his extraordinary nature that drew such events to him. Expecting it or not, he was never unprepared to bend events to his advantage. She returned the smile as she ran her hand up his chest and with a single finger stroked the bottom of his chin.
"There, there, love. Ever a bit of pleasure?
She wasn't attractive. Nonetheless, the nature of the chance opportunity instantly ignited his need. He knew what this was about. By the way she stood close, commanding his attention, he knew. He had had this kind of encounter before. In fact, he sometimes sought it out. It was more of a challenge. With challenge came a rare form of fulfillment. It wasn't an ideal situation. There were distinct disadvantages, such as not being able to allow her screams to bring attention. Yet there were still pleasures to be had, even like this. His senses opened to it. Already he was taking in the details like dry earth took in a soaking rain. He let the lust take him.
Well,
he said, drawing the word out, do you have a room? He knew she wouldn't have one. He knew what this was about. She rested a wrist over his shoulder.
Don't need no room, love. Just a half silver.
Discreetly as possible, he swept his gaze over the close buildings. The windows were all dark. Only a few lights in the distance reflected off the wet stone. This was a warehouse district. No one lived in these buildings. There weren't likely to be many people about except passers-by, like himself. Still, he knew he had to temper his lust with prudence. A little cold to be undressing out here on the cobblestones, isn't it? She put one hand on the side of his face to keep his attention focused on her. Her other hand touched him between his legs. She purred with satisfaction at what she found.
Ooh, not to worry, love. For a half silver, I'll have some place warm for you to put it.
He was enjoying the game. It had been too long. He put on his most innocent, inexperienced expression for her. Well, I don't know. This seems somewhat crude to me. I usually like it best when there's time for the young lady to enjoy it, too.
Oh, I do enjoy it, love. You don't think I do this just for the half silver, do you? Course not. I enjoy it. It's my pleasure.
She was backing toward the doorway she had come from. He let her fingers, curled behind his neck, guide him with her. I don't carry any money that small. He could almost see her eyes light with her luck. She had yet to learn that her luck this night was going to be bad.
You don't,
she said, as if preparing to withdraw her offer, now that she thought she had snared him with tempting thoughts of what she was offering.
Well, a lady has to earn a living. I guess I'll have to move along and see if I can find...
The smallest I have is a silver. But I'd be willing to give you the whole silver if it would mean you took your time and enjoyed it, too. I like lovely young ladies like you to enjoy it. That's what pleases me.
What a love,
she said, with clumsy, exaggerated delight, as she took the silver coin when he held it out. She stank. Her smile brought no beauty to her face, yet he reveled in the details. Coarse hair, the smell of her body, the humped nose and small eyes. She was common, less than a man of his stature was used to, but this had its own delights to offer. He listened carefully as he watched her. Other details were even more important if he was to have his full pleasure from this. She backed into the shallow doorway and sat on a stool waiting there. The doorway was just deep enough to hold them both, with his back to the alleyway as he stood before her. It aggravated him that she thought him so ignorant, so foolish, so impetuous. She would learn just how wrong she was. She planted a kiss on the front of his trousers as she fumbled with his belt. It wouldn't be long. She wouldn't want it to take too long before she moved on to another place, reaping all the coin she could in the cloak of night. Before she undid his trousers, he gently took her wrists in one hand. It wouldn't do to have his trousers down around his knees when it started. No, that wouldn't do at all. She smiled up at him, clearly puzzled, but just as clearly sure she was bewitching him with her smile. He wouldn't have to suffer it for long. It wouldn't be long. It was dark enough, too dark to see for sure what he was doing. People saw what they expected. While she still smiled at him, before she had time to question, he reached down with his other hand and gripped her neck. She thought he simply wished to hold her while she performed her service. The way her head was tilted back was perfect. With a thumb and a small grunt of effort, he crushed her windpipe. The smile transferred to his face. The choking sound wouldn't immediately raise suspicions. People heard what they expected to hear, just as they saw what they expected to see. He hunched over her to make it look as expected while he crushed the life out of her.
"Surprise,"
he whispered to her bulging eyes. He luxuriated in her startled, strangled expression. When her arms went limp, he let them drop and held her up by a fistful of her hair. He bent her head back over his thigh to help hold her up as he waited. He had to wait only seconds before he heard the careful footsteps approaching from behind. More than one man, as he had expected. He knew what this was about. Robbery. Mere seconds more, and they had closed the distance. To him, time stretched with the anticipation, with the details of sights, sounds, and smells. He was the most rare of men. He owned time. He owned life. He owned death. And now, it was time for the rest of his pleasure. He pushed his knee up against her spine and, with a quick yank, snapped her neck over his leg. He spun, bringing his knife up into the man right behind, slicing him open from his groin to his sternum. He spun past the man as guts slopped out into the alley. He expected another man. There were two. A woman like this usually had two men to rob the man. He had never before seen three. The unexpected danger of this development made him reel with lust. The second man on the right swung an arm. He saw the knife in the fist and, with a step back, escaped the sweep of the blade. As the third man advanced, he drove him back with a boot to the point at the base of the breastbone. The man smacked the wall behind and stumbled to his knees with a grunt of pain, unable to regain his breath. The man on the right froze. In that instant, it was one-on-one. The face was that of a boy, really, hardly a man yet. With a boy's courage, he broke and ran. He smiled. There was no more perfect target as they ran than a person's head. The head remained nearly still while the arms and legs flailed furiously. That target was a core of stability in his vision. He loosed his knife. The boy ran as fast as his rapidly pumping legs would carry him. The knife was faster, hitting home with a solid thunk. The young thief went down instantly. The third man was coming up from his knees. He was older, muscled, heavy, and violently angry.
Good.
A sidekick broke the man's nose. Howling in pain and rage, the man sprang forward. He saw a flash of steel and dodged to the side as he swept a leg beneath the man, taking his feet from under him. It all happened in a blink. It was a glorious event, this dangerous, raging bull charging madly. He pulled in the details, the man's clothes, the small rip in the back of his coat, his bald spot reflecting the distant light, his curly, greasy hair, the nick missing out of his right ear, the way he flopped when the boot landed between his shoulders. It was when he was twisting the man's arm behind his back that he saw the blood. Blood was something he kept careful track of. This blood surprised him. He hadn't cut the man. Yet. Nor was this blood from the man's crushed nose. He rarely had a thrill of surprise such as this unexpected blood brought. He realized the man was screaming in pain. He screamed louder when the shoulder joint popped. He dropped onto the man's back and smacked his head with the heel of a hand, breaking the man's teeth against the cobbles and quieting him somewhat. He gripped the greasy hair in a fist and pulled the man's head back, listening to the sound of the grunts.
Robbery is a dangerous business. Time you paid the price.
We wouldn't have hurt you,
the man burbled.
Just rob you, you bastard.
Bastard, is it?
Carefully, slowly, enjoying the detail of every inch, he slit open the man's throat as he thrashed. What unexpected pleasure this night had brought. He lifted his hands, curling his fingers, slowly sweeping the quintessence of death from the air, capturing the silken substance of it as it lifted in the darkness, and pulled it back to himself. He was the fulfillment of their lives. He was the balance. He was death. He savored seeing that awareness in their eyes. He liked it best when he could bask in that look, that knowledge, that terror. It brought him fulfillment. It made him complete. He stood, swaying in ecstasy at the cloying scent of blood. He regretted it hadn't lasted longer. He regretted not being able to enjoy prolonged screams. Screams were rapture. He craved them, needed them, lusted after them. Screams fulfilled him, made him whole. He needed the screams, not the actual sound of them. He often gagged his partners, but the attempt at them, and what they represented. Terror. Being denied the chance to leisurely enjoy the screaming terror left him unfulfilled, his lust unsated. He glided up the alley and found that his skill was as sharp as ever, as was his knife. It had found its target. The boy lay crumpled on his side. He looked delicious with the knife buried to the crossguard at the back of his head and the point of the heavy blade jutting from his forehead just slightly off-center. Immersed in a pool of sensation, he realized he felt a new one. Pain. Surprised, he inspected his arm and discovered the source of the unexpected blood. He had a gash, a good 6 inches long, on the outside of his right forearm. It was deep. It would need to be stitched. The pleasure of such an unexpected occurrence made him gasp. Danger, death, and damage all in one night, in one chance encounter. This was nearly too much. The voices had been right about coming to Aidendrill. Still, he hadn't had what he needed. The prolonged terror, the careful cutting, the slicing, the binge of blood, the giving of endless, exquisite pain, the orgy of frenzied stabbing at the end. But the voices from the ethers promised him he would have those things, promised him he would have the ultimate conquest, the ultimate balance, the ultimate pairing. They promised him he would have the ultimate consummation of debauchery. They promised him he would have the mother confessor. His time was coming. Her time was coming. Soon. When Verna dabbed the wet cloth against Warren's forehead, his eyes opened. She let out a long breath of relief. How are you feeling? He tried to sit up. With a firm hand on his chest, she gently pushed him back down into the hay. Just you lay there and rest. He winced in pain and then smacked his lips. I need a drink. Verna twisted and lifted the dipper from the bucket. She held it to his lips. His hands cupped the dented bowl of the dipper as he greedily gulped down all the water. He panted, catching his breath after the long drink. More. Verna dragged the dipper through the bucket and let him drink his fill. She smiled down at him. Glad to see you awake. It looked to be an effort for him to return the smile.
Glad to be awake. How long have I been out this time?
She shrugged, discounting his concern.
A few hours.
He glanced around the inside of the barn. Verna lifted the lamp so he could see his surroundings. Rain drummed against the roof, making it feel cozy inside. Verna set down the lamp and rested on an elbow beside him.
Not fancy lodging, but at least it's dry.
He had been nearly unconscious when they found the farm. The family who owned the farm was sympathetic. Verna had refused the offer of their bed, not wanting to force them to sleep in their own barn. On her journey of over 20-odd years, Verna had often slept in such places and found the accommodations agreeable, if a little rough. She liked the smell of hay. When she was on her journey, she had thought she hated it. But once returned to the cloistered life at the Palace of the Prophets, she changed her opinion and found herself longing for the smell of hay, dirt, grass, and rain-clean air. Warren laid a gentle hand over hers.
Verna, I'm sorry I'm slowing us down so.
Verna smiled. She recalled the time when her impatient nature would have had her pacing and fretting. Warren and his love brought out a little of her calmer nature. He was good for her. He was everything to her. She pushed back his curly blonde hair and kissed his forehead.
Nonsense. We had to stop for the night anyway. The rain would have made traveling slow and miserable. A good rest will result in more progress in the end. Take my word, I've had plenty of experience at such things.
But I feel so useless.
You are a prophet? That provides us with information that is far from useless. That in itself has saved us from traveling days in a wrong direction.
His troubled blue eyes turned to the rafters.
The headaches are coming more often with time. I fear to think that when I close my eyes I may never come awake again.
She scowled for the first time that night.
I'll not hear that sort of talk, Warren. We will make it.
He hesitated, not wanting to argue with her.
If you say so, Verna. But I'm slowing us down more all the time.
I've taken care of that.
You have? What have you done?
I hired us transportation. For a ways, at least.
Verna, you said you didn't want to hire a coach, that it would draw attention to us. You said you didn't want to risk being recognized, and you didn't want nosy people inquiring as to who was riding a coach.
Not a coach. And I don't want to hear a string of objections. I hired this farmer to take us south for a ways in his hay cart. He said we could lay in the back and you could rest. He'll cover us with hay, so we won't have to worry about people bothering us. Warren frowned.
Why would he do this for us?
I paid him well. More than that, though, he and his family are loyal to the Light. He respects the Sisters of the Light. Warren relaxed back into the hay.
Well, I guess that sounds good. You're sure he's willing? You didn't twist his nose, did you?
He was going anyway.
Really? Why?
Verna sighed. He has a sick daughter. She's only 12. He wants to go to get some tonic for her. Suspicion darkened Warren's expression.
Why didn't you cure the girl?
Verna held his gaze. I tried. I couldn't cure her. She has a high fever. She's cramping and vomiting. I tried my best. I would have given nearly anything to have been able to cure that poor child of her suffering. But I couldn't.
Any idea why not?
Verna shook her head sadly.
The gift doesn't cure everything, Warren. You know that.
If she had a broken bone, I could help her. If she had any number of ills, I could help her. But the gift is of limited use for fever.
Warren looked away. Seems unfair. They offer to help us, and we can do next to nothing for them.
I know, Verna whispered. She listened to the rain against the roof for a time. I was able to ease the pain in her gut, at least. She'll rest a little more comfortably.
Good. That's good, at least.
Warren fussed with a piece of straw.
Have you been able to get in contact with Prelate Annalena? Has she left you a message in the journey book yet?
Verna tried not to betray how troubled she was.
No, she hasn't answered my messages, nor has she sent one of her own. She's probably busy. She doesn't need to be bothered by our little problems. We'll hear from her when she has time.
Warren nodded. Verna blew out the lamp. She snuggled up to him, putting her forehead against his shoulder. She rested her arm across his chest.
We best get some sleep. At sunrise, we'll be moving on. I love you, Verna. If I die in my sleep, I want you to know that.
Verna's fingers stroked the side of his face in answer. Clarissa rubbed the sleep from her eyes. Dawn was leaking in around the edges of the heavy, dark green drapes. She sat up in the bed. She didn't think she had ever awakened feeling this good. She reached over to tell Nathan as much. Nathan wasn't with her. Clarissa sat up and swung her legs over the edge of the bed. When she stretched, her leg muscles protested. They were sore from the night's activities. She guessed it was simply the thought of the cause that made her smile at the mild ache. She had never known that sore muscles could be so pleasant. She stuffed her arms through the lovely pink robe Nathan had bought for her. She snugged the ruffles up around her neck and then tied the silk belt. She wiggled her toes in the thick carpet, luxuriating in the feeling. Nathan was at the writing desk, bent over a letter. He smiled up at her as she stood in the doorway.
Sleep well?
Clarissa half closed her eyes and sighed.
I should say so.
She grinned. What sleep I got, anyway. Nathan winked at her. He dipped the pen in a bottle of blue ink and went back to his scratching. Clarissa strolled around behind him and put her hands on his shoulders. He was wearing his trousers and nothing else. With her thumbs, she kneaded the muscles at the base of his neck. He made an agreeable sound deep in his throat, so she continued. She liked to hear his sounds of pleasure, and liked even more being their cause. As her thumbs worked along the muscles of his shoulders, she glanced down at what he was writing. Scanning the letter, she saw that it was instructions about moving troops to places she had never heard of. Nathan wrote on, admonishing a general about the bond to the Lord Rawl and the dire repercussions should he ignore it. The tone of the letter was the same authoritative tone he used when he expected people to treat him as the man of importance that he was. He signed the letter, Lord Rawl. Clarissa bent and nuzzled his neck, giving his ear a little nip.
Nathan, last night was beyond wonderful. It was magic. You were magnificent, and the luckiest woman in the world.
He gave her a roguish grin.
Magic. Yes, there was some of that in it, too. I'm an old man. I need to use what I've got.
She combed her fingers through his hair, ordering it.
Old man? I don't think so, Nathan. I hope I was half as pleasing to you as you were to me.
He laughed as he folded his letter.
Yes, I guess I did manage to keep up with you.
He slipped a hand inside her robe and pinched her bare bottom. She jumped with a squeak.
It was one of the high points of my life to be with such a beautiful and loving woman.
She hugged his head to her breasts.
Well, we're still alive. No reason we can't reach for some more of those high points.
His sly smile grew as he put his hand back on her bare bottom and gave it a squeeze. He had that lusty twinkle in his eye.
Let me dispense with this bit of business, and we'll see about getting our money's worth out of that big bed,
With a diminutive copper spoon, he scooped little nuggets of red wax from a tin and dumped the tiny spoonful on the folded letter.
Nathan, silly, you're supposed to melt the sealing wax onto the letter.
One of his eyebrows arched.
You should know by now, my dear, that my way is better.
She let out a throaty laugh.
My mistake.
He twirled a finger over the nuggets of wax. Sparkles of light danced from his finger onto the lumps of wax. They glowed briefly and then melted into a red puddle on the letter. She gasped with delight. Nathan was one never-ending little surprise after another. She felt her cheeks warm as she remembered that his fingers were magic in more ways than one. She bent and whispered intimately in his ear,
I'd like you and that magic finger of yours back in bed with me, Lord Rawl.
Nathan lifted his magic finger in proclamation.
And it shall be, my dear, just as soon as I send this letter on its way.
He again twirled the finger over the letter, and it lifted off the desk as if of its own accord. Clarissa's eyebrows rose in astonishment. The letter floated in the air ahead of him as he walked to the door. He twirled his other hand dramatically, and the door glided open. A soldier, sitting on the floor in the hall, leaning against the opposite wall, rose to his feet. He saluted with a fist to his heart. Nathan, standing there in only his trousers, with his white hair hanging down to his shoulders, had the look of a wild man. She knew he wasn't, but standing there, as tall as he was, as commanding as he was, she knew he must look that way to others. People were afraid of Nathan. She could see it in their eyes. She could understand their fear, though. She remembered how much she had feared him before she had come to know him. She could hardly remember now just how much the sight of the towering prophet had terrified her. When he turned those azure eyes on people and his hawk-like brow lowered in displeasure, she thought he could make a whole army turn and run. Nathan stretched his arm out, and the letter floated to the grim-faced soldier.
You remember all my instructions, don't you, Walsh?
The soldier snatched the letter out of the air and stuffed it inside his tunic. This soldier, though respectful, didn't seem intimidated by Nathan.
Of course, you know me better than that, Nathan.
Nathan lost a bit of his lofty attitude and scratched his head.
I guess I do.
Clarissa wondered where Nathan had found the soldier, and when he had had time to give him instructions. She guessed he must have gone out while she was asleep. The soldier looked to be somewhat different from most of the others she had seen. He had a traveling cloak with leather packs at his belt, and his clothes were of a higher quality than those of the regular soldiers she was getting used to seeing. His sword was shorter, too, and his knife longer. He was not a small man, either. He was as big as Nathan, but Nathan's bearing made him seem bigger than anyone to her.
Give the letter to General Ribish, Nathan said. And don't forget, if any of those sisters start asking you questions, you warn them about what I said, and tell them that Lord Rawl ordered you to keep what you were told to yourself. That will keep their jaws locked tight.
The soldier smiled knowingly.
I understand, Lord Rawl.
Nathan nodded.
Good. What about the others?
Soldier Walsh gestured vaguely.
Bolliston will be around to let you know what he finds out. I'm pretty sure it was only Jagang's expeditionary force, but Bolliston will find out for sure. Large as it wasn't much compared to the main force. I don't see any evidence that his main force down near Grafen Harbor has come north yet.
From what I've heard, Jagang is content to sit and wait for something. I don't know what that something is, but he's not rushing troops north into the New World.
He thrust the army I saw deep into the New World. I still think it was just his expeditionary force. Jagang is a patient man. It took him years to conquer and consolidate the Old World under his rule. He used much the same tactics, sending out the expeditionary force to take a key city or capture information of one sort or another, mostly records and books. Those men are brutal. That's part of their purpose, too, but it's the books they're sent to get. They would send back whatever they captured and wait to go wherever Jagang sends them next. Bolliston has some of our men checking into it, but they have to be careful, and it might take them a while, so just enjoy the wait.
Nathan stroked his chin as he pondered.
Yes, I imagine Jagang isn't eager to send his army into the New World yet.
He returned his gaze to Walsh.
You'd best be on your way.
Walsh nodded. His gaze shifted and his eyes met Clarissa's. He looked back to Nathan, a small smile coming to his lips.
Ah, a man after my own heart.
Nathan chuckled softly.
One of nature's wonders, matters of the heart.
The way Nathan said the words made Clarissa's own heart swell with pride to be included in matters of his heart.
You be careful here in the rat's nest, eh, Nathan? I'd not like to hear that you don't have eyes in the back of your head after all.
He patted his tunic where he had put the letter.
Especially not after I deliver this.
I will, lad. You just be sure you get that letter delivered.
You have my word.
After Nathan shut the door and business was finished, he turned to her. He had that twinkle in his eye, that lusty twinkle. His sly smile returned.
Alone, at last, my dear.
Clarissa squealed and ran for the bed in mock fright. Chapter 45.
What do you think is going on?
Anne asked. Zed stretched his head up to try to see. It was hard to get much of a look past the wall of legs around them. The Nangtong spirit hunters jabbered orders which he couldn't understand, but some of the spears pointing down from the circle surrounding them settled on his shoulders, delivering an unequivocal message that he had better stay where he was. He and Anne sat cross-legged on the ground, guarded by a ring of Nangtong, while others of them were sitting in conference a ways off with a party of Sidok.
They're too far away to hear clearly, but even if we could hear them, it probably wouldn't help much. I only speak a few words of Sidok.
Anne plucked a long blade of grass and wound it around a finger. She didn't glance over at Zed. They didn't want to give their captors the idea that they were sane and capable of plotting. Anne let out a high-pitched cackle just to keep up appearances.
What do you know about these sea doke?
Zed flapped his arms like a bird about to take to wing.
I know they don't sacrifice people.
A guard thunked a spear shaft on Zed's head as if to discourage him from any ideas of flying off. Zed howled with laughter instead of cursing, which he was longing to do. Anne glanced over out of the corner of her eye.
Beginning to reconsider your attitude about letting these Nang Tong live as they wish?
Zed smiled.
If I wanted to let them live as they wish, we'd be in the spirit world by now. Just because you believe in letting wolves be, that doesn't mean you have to let them eat your flock at will.
She grunted to concede the point. Off in the distance, beside a slight rise, the negotiations dragged on. About 10 of the Nang Tong and an equal number of the Sea Dok sat cross-legged in a circle. The Nang Tong counted out loud, accompanied by exaggerated arm movements. They pointed Zed's way. They made unintelligible but seemingly heartfelt speeches. Zed leaned toward Anne and whispered,
"The Sea Dok are peaceful enough as far as I know. I've never heard of them making war or using force against neighbors, even weaker neighbors. But when it comes to matters of trade, they're ruthless. Most people in this part of the wilds would just as soon bargain with a wolf. Other peoples teach their young people to fight. The Sea Dok teach them to barter."
Anne looked off in the other direction, as if disinterested.
"What makes them so good at it?"
Zed glanced up at their guards. They were all watching the bargaining and paying little attention to the helpless prisoners.
"They have the rare ability to walk away from a deal. Others get their minds set on something and soon start settling for less just to have a deal. The Sea Dok won't do that. They'll simply walk. When need be, they'll cut their losses without regret and move on to something else."
One of the Sea Dok, the one wearing a rabbit fur over his head, slapped a pile of blankets in the center of the circle. He pointed off to a small herd of goats and made an offer Zed understood to include two of the animals. The offer seemed to incense the Nang Tong. Their chief negotiator leaped to his feet and stabbed his spear at the sky repeatedly, apparently to express his outrage at the low price. Zed noted that he didn't walk away. There was honor involved. The Nang Tong had that much invested. Zed nudged Anne. He tilted his head back and howled like a coyote. Anne, getting the message, joined in. They both yelped and bayed as loud as they could. The negotiators fell silent as they all looked toward the prisoners. The head Nang Tong negotiator sat back down. A thunk on both their heads silenced Zed and Anne. Talking resumed over at the bartering session. A Nang Tong emissary was sent to have a better look at the goats. Zed scratched his shoulder. The dry mud was getting uncomfortable. He guessed it was less uncomfortable than having his heart cut out, or his head cut off, or whatever it was the Nang Tong did to sacrifices.
"I'm hungry," he muttered. "They haven't fed us all day. It's near to mid-afternoon, and they haven't fed us."
He barked at his captors to show his displeasure. The negotiations halted for a moment while they once again looked toward the prisoners. The Sea Dok all folded their arms and remained silent as they stared at the Nang Tong. The Nang Tong quickly resumed talking, their tone changing, becoming conciliatory. Chuckling interspersed their casual chatter. The Sea Dok's response was short and curt. The one with the rabbit skin on his head gestured toward the afternoon sun and then off toward his home. The Nang Tong man in charge pulled a blanket from the stack in the center and inspected it with grudging admiration. He passed the blanket to his fellows. They nodded with appreciation of its worth, as if just discovering it. The man sent to have a look at the goats returned with two. He showed them off to his associates, and they oohed and aahed, as if realizing for the first time that these goats were much more impressive than they had at first thought, and not at all the scraggly animals they had expected to find. The Nang Tong had apparently decided that, no matter what, they didn't want to return home with the prisoners. Any useful commodities were better than two crazy people.
They couldn't very well send the spirits, two crazy people. Any exchange for them was better than nothing, especially in view of the waning interest of the Sea Doke. The Sea Doke remained stone-faced. The Nang Tong had made a mistake. They had betrayed their need to sell what they had. There was nothing the Sea Doke valued more than a motivated seller. A price, whatever it was, Zed couldn't tell, was suddenly agreed upon. The head Sea Doke and the head Nang Tong stood, hooked arms at the elbows, and turned around each other three times while so locked together. When they parted, both sides fell to happy chatter. A bargain had been struck. The Nang Tong started lifting blankets. The goats were tethered. The Sea Doke headed for their prizes. The guards thunked Zed and Anne on the head as the Sea Doke approached, apparently in warning not to spoil the deal.
This is the end of side two. You should now change the balance control to the full right position and listen to side one again, this time hearing part B. Simply reverse this cassette, adjust the balance control to full right, and continue. If using the book cassette adapter, place the switch in the B position.